The startup game has changed, and only the most agile will make it to the other side. I'm your host, Michael Martocci, founder and CEO of SwagUp, and this is Out of the Woods, a show where we interview top startup founders, executives, and investors to hear how they're navigating the rapidly changing economic environment. We'll share real-time insights, strategies, and stories from those in the trenches with the goal to help as many teams level up their execution and make it out of the woods. So with that in mind, let's dive in. Cool. Well, welcome back to the Out of the Woods podcast. This is our third episode. Excited to get this going. You know, I've had a chance to meet Mike Beckham. Is that how you say the last name, Beckham? Like Odell Beckham Jr.?
Like the soccer player. Yeah.
And David Beckham. He's a Miami resident down here. But I had a chance to meet you, I think maybe 4 or 5 months ago through Twitter. We got on a call pretty quickly, and I think we're on that first call for maybe 2 hours, just kind of chopping it up on entrepreneurship and bootstrapping. And I think we have a lot of similar kind of tendencies and ideologies around building companies, and it was a ton of fun. And I'm super excited for you to get the chance to kind of talk with the broader audience and be able to share this conversation. So excited to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I mean, I love the theme of what you're talking about. At this point, I've been an operator for, 13, 14 years. And I think one of the things I've learned about myself is I just love operating. You know, like I love the theory and I love the high level stuff as well. But like, I love kind of rolling up your sleeves and the ingenuity and creativity and willingness to do whatever it takes. And so I love the idea of doing a podcast around helping people who are working through some of the difficulties right now and helping them to be better operators.
For sure. Yeah. My goal with this is to, maximize the number of companies that make it through to the other side, or what I call out of the woods, that maybe otherwise wouldn't have if they didn't have the right guidance and insights. So, I think your insights will be super valuable for everyone listening. But, to give people a quick background, obviously this isn't just a, story of Simple Modern and Mike, but, we'd love to kind of understand kind of where do you come from? How'd you get your entrepreneurial kind of genes and start? And, you're running Simple Modern now, but you also had some other e-commerce, companies in the past. Kind of what's the through line for your story?
Sure. So I'll give the kind of 2 or 3 minute version. Was finance major in college, actually kind of to the surprise of many people when I graduated. I went into the nonprofit world. I was actually in the ministry world for almost 10 years. By the time I got to 30, it was like, well, I guess I'm not going to work in the business world. But I actually really enjoyed the nonprofit world. I have a younger brother. He's about 2.5 years younger than me, who had started like an affiliate marketing company, done really well. And he approached me right around my 30th birthday and said, "Hey, I really want to start a business. Would you be willing to help me do this?" I thought this would be a great kind of side project, like nights and weekends. And I'd love to, stay engaged in business. And so I said, sure. We recruited some people, started a company. It was like an online auction company. Founded it in October 2009. By November 2010, had our first $1 million revenue day. That business would generate, I think, about $1 billion in revenue over about a 7-year period. And so no idea, no idea what I was walking into when I said, yes, I'll help on this. It was just, the whole thing was crazy, and it was kind of like exactly what you'd expect. I was the oldest person at the company and I was 30. There's Nerf guns all over the office. It's kind of the inmates running the asylum. It's kicked off this process of me just learning so much. I'm basically working 2 full-time jobs at this point. I'm working in the nonprofit world. I'm working, I'm running all of the econ side of this business, which is a really econ heavy business because it's an auction model. And then we got pregnant with our first kid, Carter, who's behind me here in the photo. And I just realized I can't do all this at a high level. I can't be the dad I want to be and do all these different things. I was probably working 80 or 90 hours a week, some weeks. And so my wife and I talked about it, decided really we felt like the ability to make the most impact was probably in the business world. Moved into the business world with my brother, started a couple more businesses with him, and really just learned a ton. I tell people that it was like getting an MBA on crack, because when you run an e-com business, you just have to know so much about so many different areas, from, digital marketing to conversion rate optimization to HR to legal to, technology. Like there's a ton. And by the time we got to about 2015, I started to feel like, hey, I really think I'd like to start a company of my own. There were a couple of guys I'd worked with at the company with my brother who were really interested in starting something with me, approached me and said, hey, would you be open to it? At the beginning, we didn't know we wanted to do a drinkware company. We more knew the kind of culture that we wanted to create and that we wanted to be digital first in our sales philosophy. And basically that Simple Modern was born. Took us probably 6 months to decide that we wanted to try something in drinkware, which has obviously gone pretty well for us. But I tell people all the time that, you know, we're a company that's about generosity and it's about healthy culture and is about, you know, solid entrepreneurship. And we just so happen to sell drinkware. So at this point, year six, we're a 100 million plus revenue company. We're the biggest unit supplier in our category to Amazon, Target, Nationwide and Walmart, Sam's Club. So pretty big distribution footprint. Our distribution and obviously our website, our distribution footprint is mainly working with the very biggest players, and doing things at mass scale. So I've had over, you know, I guess 13 years. I'm kind of becoming one of the OGs of e-commerce. Like I go back to when there wasn't AWS, you actually owned your servers and you had to own like a locker where they were like, where you maintained these physical servers. And, you know, back when things like Shopify weren't really solutions. So I've been around and seen a bit, but have been an operator that entire time. And like you said, love talking about practically, how do you do this? You know, what's the blocking and tackling of being a really sound and successful operator?
Well, you even teach at some of the local universities, I think, right? For entrepreneurship.
I do. I do a lot of stuff with the University of Oklahoma. That's where I went. And then I never left Norman. I didn't necessarily anticipate staying in Norman my entire life, but it's just kind of how things have worked out. And so I spend a lot of time talking to students. Oklahoma is not exactly known for having like a thriving entrepreneurship community. So I've become a little bit of kind of like the guy you come and talk to when you have an idea, which is a lot of fun. I mean, you said it about your podcast. You want to help as many companies get through this challenging stretch as possible. I view kind of part of my life mission is helping as many people that want to create things and build things of value. I want to help them how I can, because I've just been fortunate to, you know, I've been fortunate to be a part of the things that I've been a part of and to have a front row seat, you know, with some of the biggest companies in the world. And so anytime I can find a way to share that information in a way that's helpful to other people, I want to do it.
Love it. Awesome. Well, real quick, before we dive into some of the tactical stuff, like what'd you learn from the nonprofit? Like how you were in that space for a long time. Was that able to be leveraged in the private sector as well? The lessons?
It's amazing how much it made me a more effective business person. I mean, I think to start with, Michael, business is still about people. You'll hear people say, you know, I started this business to run a business and I realized it was all about managing people. But it's like, that really is true that, you know, at a fundamental level, success in business is about working with others, other people wanting to cooperate with you, wanting to buy from you, believing in you. One of the analogies I'll give is, you know, if you go back 300-400 years, you know, all commerce was heavily relational. So like if I'm buying bread, I'm going to the town baker and I kind of know there's two town bakers and I like this one and not that one because I know about this one's marriage and how he treats his kids, you know, whatever. There's like all this context I know. And then with industrialization, there's been this disintermediation between us and the people that we're buying from. But I think one of the reasons why the internet and social media has moved us back towards, we really are geared and wired to want to know who we're buying from and what they're about. And so that's true from a customer perspective. I think from like an employee perspective, so much of attracting great people, retaining great people, building a culture where you win is about being able to cast vision. It's about being someone that people want to follow, people that people believe in, having a vision that's compelling, all this stuff. And so the nonprofit world, I think, taught me a ton. It taught me a ton about how to develop and treat people, about how to cast a compelling vision, about how we can all be a part of working on something that's bigger than ourselves. These are like basic human needs, it turns out. And when you apply them in the business world, it's really powerful. One more example is, I realized this in retrospect, even being in the nonprofit world, I was in sales. You know, so many jobs are really sales jobs where it's like, the point of this job is for me to communicate a principle persuasively to somebody else. And so I never would have thought about myself as a salesperson. But then when I started Simple Modern, I realized, wow, I really do have the ability to build a compelling case for our product or why people want to partner with us. That's helped us tremendously when it comes to these mass retail partners. Well, that I developed that in the nonprofit world. Probably the final thing we're saying is just ultimately your character matters a ton. There are things where there's kind of like life hacks for things, but there's no life hack for character. I believe that character is one of those things that kind of compounds over the course of your life. And when you have character and that leads to quality decisions and you treat people well over the course of your career and your life, that compounds and it just leads to all kinds of benefits and things going better that you can't necessarily anticipate. So anyway, those are a few of the ways. But yeah, it turns out that my years in the nonprofit world were actually tremendous, just not just for me as a person, but also for me as a business owner and operator.
I think the character part resonates a lot with us because, one of the values at SwagUp is trust over profit. And it's this idea that, business is a long game. Entrepreneurship is a long game. You want to build strong relationships over the long term. And ultimately, that's like 100% aligned with driving profits and shareholder value over the long term, because you're building those connections with people and they trust you and they go back to you as an expert and they're willing to buy from you and they want to be your supplier and all these kinds of things. And you want to build that ecosystem around you and the company and the brand for the long term, I think. And I think it's the same kind of thing. It's also interesting because, the Mormon kind of missionary, group of people has had such an incredible run as businessmen and businesswomen, yeah, over the last few years. And I think it's kind of some of those principles you've talked about in the nonprofit world that, allow them to build great businesses as well.
Yeah, so, I totally agree. There's a lot of principles that cross apply. And, one other benefit for me is during my years in the nonprofit world, I met some tremendous people, got to mentor some tremendous people. And we have quite a few of those people on our team today. So even some of my coworkers came from that period. In fact, one of the things that's unique about us as a business is I bet somewhere between 60 and 80% of the people that work full time for Simple Modern have some kind of background in the nonprofit world. At some point in time, work for a nonprofit. Yeah.
And they're all, your whole team is in the Oklahoma area or
most
some remote?
Of it. Our development team is in Nashville, Tennessee, and then everybody else basically is here in Oklahoma.
Which is pretty, countercultural right now because so many companies have gone remote. Has that been do you think that's a driving force for like the type of culture that you're trying to build and the type of company that you're trying to build by having everybody together?
Yeah. So there's really two things you can have a monopoly on legally, and only two: your brand and your team. And I what I've observed about the remote work is that obviously it's really popular right now. For some people, I think it's popular because they're saying, I can go and get more talented people. For some people, I think it's popular because they're saying, I can get the same work for less expensively. And listen, there's some situations where I can totally understand that. But I think in the intermediate to long term, I think it's a huge competitive advantage when your team is relationally bonded with each other. Probably the worst part of remote work is that we're a lot less relationally bonded with people that we're working with that live hundreds or thousands of miles away. And as a result, I think people that are working remote jobs are going to be more transient. The statistics say this, you're just going to change jobs more frequently. And so, compounding, the whole principle of compounding is the way you get compounding is by once you have something good, you keep it going for a long period of time. So if your team is like a huge competitive advantage, and for it to really create the value and bear the fruit that you want it to bear requires getting a great team and then keeping it for a long period of time, that's where I think the relational connectedness piece really matters a bunch. I mean, the other thing is that we do a lot of stuff in the physical world, and you and I can have this podcast very effectively. You're in Miami, I'm here. it's just as good as if you were sitting in the room next door to me. But the moment that we start talking about like a new product that we're trying to release and looking at samples and stuff, well, that breaks down, right? And yep. Like, I think that the ability to make the best products we possibly can, I think that by, you know, because we were remote for about 8 to 12 months during COVID, and I felt like that broke down some. I think the other thing that breaks down with remote is that there's a serendipity of conversations that happens in an office or, you know, a warehouse or whatever, where, you know, there's no meeting on the schedule, but I walk in by somebody's office and a thought pops into my head and that leads to a conversation. And then you go grab another person. And before you know it, you've got this new initiative or idea or insight that just kind of spontaneously generated. And I found that during the remote period of COVID, I felt like that just did not happen nearly as much, almost at all. It was more like, okay, what are my meetings for the day? And then I'm kind of compartmentalized thinking about those things. So those are some of my observations, that because I really felt like I had to make a decision at the end of COVID. Are we going to be a distributed team? Are we going to be in one place? And for all those reasons, I really doubled down on physical location.
Yeah, I think it all adds up too. Like even just unblocking somebody, like, hey, let me walk by your office. And like, I just have this question because I got to move through this project versus, oh, let's schedule time like next Thursday for an hour and talk through it. And all those things just kind of, you know, snowball on top of each other and just make the organization run a lot less smooth. Yeah. Obviously, there's pros and cons of both sides. Like we, you know, candidly, we got a little bit stuck, I think, at this point. So we obviously have a distribution center in New Jersey with, you know, 80 people plus or minus. And then we have a small office in Miami. But then the rest of the team is kind of spread out. And we were just moving really fast and growing really quickly through through the pandemic, that we needed to hire people quickly. And the labor market was so tight, so that we kind of like forced us to hire outside of the locales that we were in. But looking back, you know, I would love to try to start to tighten that back up again and have at least regional offices or start to hire in more specific areas, because it's very hard to keep that kind of magic of what makes a startup run so well and move so fast when people are all over the place. And like you said, like I think the average tenure at a startup right now has got to be like 18 months. Yeah. People are constantly in and out, moving to the next job, using it as a stepping stone. And you know, you can over-index on culture and stuff and try to keep people, but I just think it's very hard when you don't, like you said, like some of these people, you join a company for 18 months, you still never met some of the people that you're working with. And it's so hard to kind of have that bond with them and understand how they work. So
one of the things we're at like maybe 80 people. We've probably hired 20 in the last 6 months. I mean, I feel like, and these are people that are here, man, there's people on my team that I still haven't had more than one good conversation with, you know, and I feel that, and we are in the same physical location, you know, if you're talking about a really quickly growing team that's distributed, that just becomes more challenging. Like you said, I think that's one of the challenges just of quickly growing a business in general, is how do you maintain any kind of culture while you're rapidly adding headcount? And the more distributed you are, the more challenging that is.
Yep, for sure. So as you see, obviously, if you're on Twitter on a daily basis or watching the news, there's all this different doom and gloom type conversations going on with inflation and recession and the markets. But then you have other people talking about how, you know, some prices of commodities are coming down and you know, you have the war. There's just so many different things going on. It's really hard to get a clear sense of what to, you know, what to think is legitimate and what's not. Like, what's your take on the current environment? Like, where do you see the next, you know, what led to it and what's going to happen over the next 12 months in your mind?
So I think in general, like COVID obviously set off a number of kind of cascading failures across the supply chain and set off some government policies that were probably effective in staving off kind of a worst case scenario, but also had all kinds of second, third order effects that were not positive. And so we're in the process of working through all of that. And every time you kind of try and fix one thing, there's another thing that goes, you know, it becomes abnormal and it continues to kind of ripple out. I'm more hopeful, I think, that we're going to see some normalization over the next year. I think that right now the average retailer and brand is pretty heavy on inventory. And I don't, there's not a lot of activity flowing through China right now. Like the China manufacturing numbers, I don't know what the official kind of CCP numbers are, but they're, it can't be very good because everybody, all my contacts that I talk to just kind of across industries is trying to figure out how do we stay lean? How do we go lighter on inventory? And in general, like all of the clearance and sales and stuff that you're seeing this summer, that's deflationary. So I'm kind of hopeful that we're going to see some kind of normalization. Now there's definitely been some kind of pretend wealth or that had been generated in some areas like crypto and NFTs and, you know, real estate that like, that's going to go away. And maybe that's going to hurt. I mean, like my guess is I could see luxury spending taking a step back and maybe not being sustainable of like the 2021 levels, but I'm still optimistic about the economy doesn't seem to have like a fatal flaw in it. And I'm hopeful that we work through things. You know, it's easy to talk yourself into like worst case scenarios. Like you look at the national debt, you look at different things. But then you look at other countries and it's like, well, kind of everybody has problems and it's easy. One of the things I've found is it's easy to sound smart when you're pessimistic. But generally the course of, you know, the last 100 years, the course of human history, optimism ends up being, you know, the more accurate perspective. So I would say I'm cautiously optimistic, but for sure there are some challenges that have to be worked through. And there are some companies where like their focus really needs to be like becoming as fundamentally strong as you can over the next 12 to 18 months, because there is no guarantee we don't go into recession. There's no guarantee that we don't have a really challenging stretch. And anything that you're doing in your business that isn't sustainable in that kind of environment, you need to stop doing it, you know, because you can't just, hope isn't a great option, right? So one of the ways that I do think about it though, like to kind of take a step back and give a tactical thing, we're constantly investing money in inventory. And I think one of the things that I realize is I'm not going to be able to make an aggressive bet in every area of the business that I feel good about because of the environment, because of the uncertainty. So maybe there's 5 product lines where I'm like, hey, I think we could, you know, grow 50% or we could double next year. Well, I'm not going to make the inventory investments to try and do that. That's probably a function of the uncertainty that we're in. Now, I'm not going to cut my investment back to zero, but I'm going to have a higher standard of like, what does it take for me to want to really lean into a product category or really lean into inventory? One pretty tactical perspective on that is that I think every brand who's running with inventory has to increase their return on invested capital. So this is a stat that we look at. How much money do we have sitting in inventory? And what are our turns? What are our margins? So what's the return on that number? And because everybody is going to be reticent to really be piling on inventory right now, everybody has to do is say, I've got to generate more return off the inventory that I do have. So that's pricing, that's margins, that's buying tighter turns. We have a lot of product categories. Like here's a good example. We're in licensed product. I wrote a thread about it this week. Sports licensing is incredibly seasonal. You do like almost 80% of your volume in
like college football.
It's interesting. It's all around gifting. It's not even during the season. It's around the gifting season. So there's like a 3-week period in December where you do 80% of your volume for the year. So when you miss on a really highly seasonal product, when you under or over guess on demand, then you're just kind of sitting on it for an entire year. And there's no way to really unwind that position during, the months of January and February and March or whatever. Plus with license, there's some channel kind of restrictions about where you can sell it. So for us, that inventory is great. We love being a partner with those institutions, but there's a lot more inventory risk. And because we're in a time of uncertainty, we have to look at product categories where there's more inventory risk and we have to buy more conservatively and we have to generate higher returns on invested capital. So like a really simple way of thinking about it as a business owner is the risk profile, if you're a business owner, has gone up. There's more uncertainty and there's more risk. And so you have to generate more return on any investment. That should be, you know, just like in the market, the more risky the stock you buy, the more potential return you should be looking for. Same exact thing with inventory. The more risky the environment, the more return you should be expecting to generate off your inventory. It's a good kind of fundamental idea.
Yeah, I mean, you have a finance background. It's kind of like a hurdle. The hurdle rate has gone up. You know, the cost of capital has gone up because of the risk-free rate is higher.
Yeah.
You know, so instead of, you know, everything is profitable at 6% hurdle rate, maybe it's 12% now, or it's 10%. And now that changes how you view investments that you're making, because you're like, hey, I'd rather than maybe I put that money into bonds at 6% for now instead of, you know, some risky inventory that may or may not sell through, or something to that effect. And that's, you know, what investors or LPs might be thinking about as well when it comes to like the more risky side of the investment.
Yeah, you can also kind of tranche your revenue, Michael, and there's different levels of like your bottom line on your income statement. Not all revenue is created equal. And especially, you know, when you're growing a business, I mean, I'm as guilty. It's funny, we have this thing in the company, the top liners and the bottom liners, and I'm like king of the top liners. And it's kind of like the like, let's drive sales, let's go, let's grow, you know, kind of team. And then like my CFO is like the, you know, the chief of the bottom liners. And it's like, yeah, that's okay. But like, we have to be doing this in a profitable way. And so one activity that's really, I think, positive for any business is to tranche your income statement and to understand like, what is the highest quality income that you drive, where you're, you know, and that can be consistency, profitability, the amount of overhead it takes to, you know, to drive it, the amount of inventory it takes to support it. And when you tranche your inventory, it'll, or not your inventory, when you tranche your revenue, it makes it easier to understand like, okay, maybe instead of growing 25% next year, we want to grow 15%. But the way we want to do it is not give up any growth in these three areas and just, you know, be fine with being flat here and here, because that's a lower quality revenue for us. And the more that you have a clear kind of perspective on what is the most effective business and revenue to drive your company forward, and focus on that. It's been a helpful kind of thought process for me.
Well, it's a good segue, because I wanted to talk about, like, you guys are in some different channels. Obviously, you have direct to consumer, you have marketplace, you have retailers. Kind of, you know, what are you seeing out of those different channels? How are you, you know, given the current environment, how are you reacting or changing the strategy in those different channels? Which ones are driving growth? Which ones are harder? I know, like you said, you know, the retailers are maybe placing smaller purchases, or they're putting some stuff onto liquidation. You know, how is that all impacting the strategy?
Yeah, so the general theme is that everybody's heavy on inventory, you know, more or less to give like the 30-second version. COVID hits, everybody stops ordering. We realize the world's not ending in a zombie apocalypse. Everybody starts ordering. There's this bullwhip effect in the supply chain. Everything gets more expensive. Everything's taking longer. Everybody responds by having to plan further out and buying more inventory. And then, you know, you get some kind of partially you get a slowdown, and part of it's just like people were just guessing. You know, like if you think about last year, a lot of the buying that everybody did was based on what they thought would happen in summer of 2022, based on this March through, you know, August, we'll call it, period of 2021, when the government was just dropping copious amounts of stimulus on everybody. So like everybody was just like, how do you project that, right? Like nobody knows. So everybody was wrong in their projections, and everybody's heavy on inventory. That's the theme. Amazon, the traffic's definitely down year over year. Like no doubt. I've seen different numbers, 8 to 20%, probably depending on product category. I'm sure some are even more than that. But there's a lot of product categories where there's just not as many eyeballs, there's not as many people looking to buy that product. And then in the mass retailers, you have a similar situation, but it's a little bit different. With like Target, for example, like Target did a lot of direct import, where the retailer takes responsibility for the inventory overseas. They kind of buy it overseas and then they bring it in. And there's some reasons why Target's and Walmart have done more white labeling and more direct import. it's positive from a margin perspective. The downside is you get stuck in a situation where the inventory doesn't get here on time or the inventory doesn't move, and all of a sudden it's your problem, not the brand's. And that's pretty much what happened. So you've got companies like Target that, like, what happens when you buy 50 containers of Christmas trees and then they get here in January 10th because they were stuck in the port, right? Well, you got a problem, right? And that's pretty much what has happened, is that these retail chains just have a bunch of inventory that, due to delays or due to kind of inaccurate forecasting, they're just crazy heavy in some areas, and they've got to get that. So their working capital is kind of, I saw one of the guys I follow who is a very big investor in Amazon was saying, I don't see any way Amazon doesn't have to do some kind of a raise, which is crazy to think about. Amazon might need some liquidity, but like all of them have a ton of their working capital and inventory right now. So what they're all trying to do is figure out, how do I just unload as much of this inventory as possible to turn it into liquidity? So we've seen it, with Target, the ordering has been sporadic. With Walmart, they bought a bunch in March for like the set, and then it hasn't moved as quickly as they thought. And so what it means for us is like, oh, okay, you've got a couple months where you're not getting much, you're not getting nearly what you thought in terms of cash flow and POs. So this is what everybody's experiencing, is that because the retailers have these kind of working capital and inventory problems, you're not getting the cash flow as a brand that you would expect selling into them. And I think our CFO was telling me that, like, there was a point where we were coming in almost something like $1 million short a week or every couple of weeks on cash flow, just because the ordering had been so disrupted. So short term, they got to work through it. You know, it's like, it's clearances, it's sales, it's people getting right. I think on the digital side, with D2C, we've seen it as kind of a flattish year. I think most of the people that are smart that I'm talking to, the kind of aggregated numbers I'm looking at, is that if you're doing better than flat year over year on kind of D2C, then you're probably doing great. You're probably in the stronger kind of camp. What everybody's going to do, Michael, this is kind of the too long didn't read. What everybody who buys inventory is going to do is they're going to buy less. They're going to do exactly what I said. They're going to say, I need to up my yield on inventory. I need to have tighter turns. I need to not do this again, because this is bad. And so what we're going to be in next summer probably is everybody's going to be light on inventory. You're going to have, because that's how it works, right? It's like, you have action.
The bullwhip goes both ways, right?
And that's exactly what will happen. The retailers, you know, after COVID, they were like short in some product categories like exercise equipment. I bet Target has home exercise equipment for the next 4 years in their supply chain, right? Now, do I feel confident enough to like buy heavy on inventory so that I'm in stock when everybody else is out of stock? I don't. You know, like, I'm not going to step in front of that. So this is kind of the nature of retail. They say retail is kind of a ditch-to-ditch industry. Like, it's this, you overcompensate one way and then you overcompensate the other. And right now, because everybody's heavy on inventory, I think you're going to see everybody try and overcompensate towards buying less. The positives of that are things like container costs. I mean, that stuff's going down.
It's all deflationary stuff.
That's right. And that's actually, if you look at the bond market, this is what the bond market's basically saying. The bond market freaked out. There was this period where mortgage rates went all the way to like 6.5%, and they've since backed off. Because I think what Wall Street thinks right now is that the Federal Reserve isn't going to have to raise as much as they thought, because they've raised and there's these deflationary forces and that inflation is going to come down. So we'll see. But that's at least what the market thinks right now.
Yeah, I think like the 10-year and the mortgage rates have come back down like 15-20% from the highs, because they just don't believe that the Fed's going to be able to keep hiking up, because a lot of this stuff is very transitory stuff that's big booms and big busts. But what if you think about, like, what gives you the confidence, and like, what's the thing that you're looking externally for the signal that says, hey, let's place big inventory buys, let's get aggressive again as a business? Like, or is there something you can point to say, hey, that's going to give us the confidence?
Well, this is the thing that's great about cash flow, and it's a great thing about kind of being an owner operator, is that as long as I'm spending money that I have, that we are generating from cash flow, then even if I'm wrong, it's fine, right? It's when I'm spending money that I don't have, or if I'm wrong, the business goes under, or I lose my job because the investors want to see a certain number. That's a different kind of situation. So this is the great thing about bootstrapping. When you're bootstrapping, it's like, well, my cash flow is my reinvestable money, and I'm gonna reinvest it the best I know how. And I still, you know, regardless of the environment, the return on investment that I can make inside of my business is so much better than the public markets, right? Like, we can hit many times triple digit internal return on investment. And so, okay, maybe it's a bad environment and that's 50%. Well, that's so much better than like me going out there and trying to pick stocks, even though it's something I like to play with. I think the principles are like, we're not going to spend money we don't have. We're going to fund our growth, and we're going to be more picky and discerning about what we put money behind. But that's kind of a principle that regardless of what's going on out there is true. The other principle, and I think this is a really helpful one for me, I can't control the economy. The economy goes up 5% next year, goes down 5%. I can't control that. I can't even predict it. I'm guessing, right? And it, me trying to claim that I would know, it's nothing more than a guess. But what I can watch is, what is my relative competitive positioning in the market? And I'm going to make investments so that I maintain or improve my competitive positioning. Because like, for example, on Amazon, I can't control how many people show up to Amazon and want to buy a Tumblr. I don't have any control over that. But what I'm going to focus on is, when they do, I want my market share to be at least this or greater. You know, like, I care about how I'm doing relative to my competitors with the opportunity that's there. And you can do that same thing with Target or Walmart or whatever. And so I don't know what the overall kind of nominal demand is going to be in my product category, but I want to make investments where, if anything, I gain competitive advantage, and I don't lose ground. And that's usually my defining principle. And it's part of it's that keeping a long-term mindset, even when things are hard, because it's easy when things are hard to start, you know, you have short-term things you have to do, but it can drive you to make concessions that harm your long-term vision or profitability or, you know, or trajectory. And so what we're going to do is, we're going to invest our cash flow in the best investments we have, with a higher expectation on return on invested capital, and with an eye towards long-term competitive advantage. And as long as you do that, whether the economy goes up, down, whatever, you're going to be in a pretty good spot, is kind of my view.
Is there a part of you that says, you know, hey, like, I actually kind of enjoy these rocky kind of climates because they create volatility and opportunity? You know, if you look at hedge funds love, you know, volatile markets, because that's where all the opportunity is. Like, where do you see some of the opportunity for you guys to maybe pull ahead? I mean, one of the dichotomies I think about a lot is, like, you know, we are, and you guys are still a relatively small company in the broad scheme of the economy. And there's still so much opportunity for growth. You talk about licensing being the fastest growing part of the business. You'll probably do 20 million there. Like, do you see still just a lot of opportunities to stay aggressive and pull ahead of maybe other companies that aren't planning as well, or maybe aren't as fundamentally sound?
Yeah. So the last 2 years have been really emotionally hard for me, because I'm an operator, and I've poured kind of my heart and soul into being an operator. And then you see things where people have, you know, seen a lot of financial success with not a lot of production and not a lot of work, right?
Yep.
And it grates on you. And you know it's not sustainable, but it still bothers you. I think when there's just a ton of money sloshing around, in general, it's not a fun environment for the best operators, because they don't need cheap money. You know, they don't need PE money or VC money. They don't need stimulus.
Creates a lot of noise.
They were already, it's a bunch of noise. And what it does, it, like, in a category, you know, you might be in a category where in a normal year, you're growing 25%, your competitors are growing 12. Well, now all of a sudden, if there's a bunch of money sloshing around, maybe you're growing at 60% and everybody else is growing at 45%. You know, like, you're still quite a bit better than your competitors, but it looks like everybody's just killing it. When you go the opposite side of that, when it's a tough environment, all of a sudden all your competitors are shrinking at 10% and you're growing at 15%. And it highlights the difference to all of your partners of like, this is the winning horse, right? So for us, I think licensing is a good example. The more licensing we've done, the more we've been approached. The larger the partnerships have gotten and the more we've been approached because we've really shown our competence and that we can do this at a best in the world kind of level. Same thing with the retailers. There's an award, one of the syndicated data organizations, NPD, has named us the fastest growing company in our industry for 2 years in a row. We're going to win it again this year, I think, based on like internal numbers. And that stuff really goes a long way in helping these retail partners to see you as a key place that they want to invest. So I think one thing is just like, it becomes more clear who the best operators are when things are not good. And then I think the other thing, like you said, is there's all kinds of opportunities. Some are kind of predictable and some are not. The predictable ones are like in a downturn, your weakest firms are always going to go under. And the market share that they were going to take up is going to get redistributed to your stronger firms, making your stronger firms stronger. Or you're going to see acquisitions and kind of consolidation. But that's always makes the strongest firms stronger. Then there's also just opportunities that'll arise that you're not anticipating, whether that's your manufacturing costs getting more affordable or the ability to expand a partnership or whatever else. I mean, when you have money to invest, when you're generating growth and other people aren't, there's going to be things that come your way. So I love it. I love the challenging environments. I just think there's more surface area for you to make key strategic decisions that allow you to differentiate and separate yourself from, like, one way to just think about it is the more strategic decisions you have to make, the more the strongest teams will outperform the weakest teams. And so in an environment where everybody has more demand than they can service, there's not a ton of strategic decisions to be made. It's more like we're just trying to kind of keep up with things. In an environment like this, where it's all strategic decision-making about how much you're investing in inventory and pricing and margins and overhead and all this other stuff, there's so much surface area where the strongest operators are going to separate themselves from the pack. And you know, I don't know what the axiom is, but it's something about, you know, that fortunes are made in bear markets. But it's that kind of idea is that when things get hard and everybody else tightens up, I mean, this is the other thing. When things are uncertain, people tighten up. They don't invest. If you're able to keep a long-term perspective and you're able to keep investing when everybody else is uncertain, that's actually, not only do you get the best valuations, but you end up having like a 12 or 18 or 24 month period where you continued to invest in the future growth and nobody else did. And then you look up and you're just, you know, you just have moved way ahead of some of your competitors because of their fearfulness and conservativeness. So you have to do it in an intelligent way, obviously, but I think it can be really helpful.
Yeah, I think it's such a great way to look at it. It's like the distribution of outcomes is so much wider in an environment like this. You know, the decisions that you make as a team, as a company, could either catapult you 10x, could, you know, kill the business. Whereas in a good market, it's a much tighter, you know, you can't really pull ahead that much more than the next company. And, you know, I think it's a good environment for the companies that are able to make hard decisions, make them quickly, be really smart about what they're doing. But, and then the point about uncertainty equaling not investing, I mean, that's kind of what's happening in the venture world. You know, you're going to see some of the best venture returns ever in this environment, you know, and then some others are just going to sit on the sidelines and say, hey, we don't want to invest in this environment because we're too uncertain, even though they have 10-year horizons. You know, you're going to have some of the best price seed funds ever, because the last few years, if you think about the distribution of outcomes, you know, in a bull market, it's hard to outperform the next venture fund. But in today's environment, now you can actually provide, you know, real alpha and be much better than the next, because you're going to make hard decisions about companies that maybe are out of favor or, you know, aren't getting the same valuation that they were, you know, 2 years ago. So on that note,
I have a general thought. Like, I've got this uncanny ability to somewhat time the market. And The reason why I have it is because it's a really straightforward thing. If you just watch people's psychology and say the moments when people are like, this is easy, of course you'd want to invest, of course you want to use leverage, of course you want to, like, those are always the moments when you don't want to be investing. And if you look at the moments when everybody's like, I am terrified, the last thing I want to do is invest right now, I want to hold on to things, those are always the best moments to invest. And for obvious reasons, because of psychology. And so in that same way, like you talked about the VC world, it's a great example. The VCs that are going to have the best returns 5 years from now, there's going to be two things that were true of them. One was when everybody else was trying to get any SaaS deal you possibly could, they were staying disciplined and probably missing out on deals because no, we're not going to fund, you know, we're not going to value you at 1,000x, you know, ARR. And now they're the same ones that are like, yeah, we're open for business and we are funding companies. So the discipline, and this is the hard part, the discipline is when emotionally you're going to feel the best about investments is always the time that you should be thinking the most critically about them, because it's at least possible, probably even likely, that you're investing more towards the top and that's why you feel so good about it and that it can't miss. And the investments that are likely to be your biggest returns are always going to feel the most emotionally difficult. And so creating this dichotomy between your intellectual self and your emotional self when you make investments is really difficult. You know, a great example, when can you hire the most talented people? It's not at a market top. That's the period where it feels like, oh yeah, we can hire more people. Yeah, we can pay that guy $175,000. But that's actually the most difficult time to acquire those people. And when you do, you overpay. When you're acquiring team members and adding team members during a period where jobs are scarcer and things are harder, that's when the most talented people usually are hired. There's a great story about the PayPal Mafia. You know, a lot of people are familiar with the PayPal Mafia. I'll just kind of introduce the idea. It's basically like PayPal had this group of people, Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, Keith Raboy,
David Sachs, Peter Thiel.
Yeah, I mean, Peter Thiel. Yeah, it's absurd, right? There's a picture somewhere of all these guys.
Max Levchin.
Like, yeah, it's literally like 7 or 8 billionaires. And they all work there at the same time. And it's like, well, how did that happen? So obviously some of the answer is, well, there was probably something about those guys working together that helped them to develop skills and abilities that they've been successful later in life. But there's another explanation as well. It turns out that when they built most of their team was 2000, 2001, and they were one of one or two companies in the entire Silicon Valley ecosystem that was actually hiring, because you've gone through this huge dot-com bust and they were able to go out and hire the very best people because they were open for business when nobody else was. So it's like, is Elon Musk because he worked with those guys at PayPal? You know, is that why, you know, he's been, it's like, no. He's Elon Musk. He would have been successful in any context. The reason why all those guys got together more than anything else is that PayPal was able to be hiring and thinking about the future when everybody else didn't have capital and was in kind of preservation mode. And that's possible for all of us. There are great people that are going to be out there that are going to be available and open to work. So whether it's investing in inventory or investing in your team, there's going to be some real opportunities.
Yeah, no, I think the idea of like market tops, like in the stock market, is the same thing as making investments in your company. You might say, hey, everything's great, you know, you can't miss. Let's open up a second warehouse facility. Let's buy $10 million worth of inventory and start to do things further and further on the risk curve. And not to say that you shouldn't take risks, but you really need to check yourself and make sure you're thinking about this from a first principle standpoint, not just because, oh, you feel like you have the magic touch and anything's going to kind of win and you can't lose anymore.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's that kind of like over exuberance that can kill you. I think you ever read the book?
It's just the emotional side. It's like the moment that your emotion starts to override your ability to critically think about a decision. And I can be as guilty of it as anybody. Like
that's you're a top line optimist, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like the way I want to see the world is optimistic. And so, you know, I think one of the things that you need to do is you got to build a team of people that are not afraid to tell you what they think and view it a different way. Like there's times when like I have, like one of the ways I'll express this is your organization should have accelerators and brake pads. And the brake pad people will drive you crazy sometimes when you're a CEO and you're a top line guy and you're an accelerator, but you have to have them. And it's times like, you know, like it's when things, ironically, it's when things are really good that those voices are the most important, because those are the few people that are going to be saying, I know it looks good, but you know, like this might not be a good idea. And when every emotional, you know, response is like, let's go big, we're going to take over the world. And then those people are actually less helpful when in a downturn, ironically. Ironically, although their skill sets are around being conservative, they're going to be less helpful when things look more gloomy, because that's going to cause them to be even more conservative. And that's when your kind of your optimists and your kind of visionaries have to say, like, okay, hey, we've got to keep our eyes on the long-term vision. We got to keep investing. We can't allow, you know, the economy or external factors to take us off course. So you got to have both. Although, ironically, the time that you need to listen to each is the opposite of what you think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the, you ever read the book, The Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham?
Yes. That's it. Yeah,
it has a lot of these principles, you know. It's just the fundamentals that you know, just are always true about when to make investments, when to be conservative and not get swayed by emotion. That's like one of the first books I read when I was 13 in finance and investing.
That's
and,
awesome.
You know, I think that book was very much out of favor over the last few years. And I bet if you look at Amazon sell-through data, it probably was down 50-60%. And there was, you know, there was people these last few years saying that Warren Buffett is an old guy that doesn't know what's going on anymore. And, you know, we can't really listen to him. He's past his prime. He's the one laughing right now that's sitting on, you know, hundreds of billions in cash. Has a bunch of these cash flowing assets that aren't losing money right now, and has a bunch of opportunities to pick up, you know, assets cheap. So I think, you know, it's very important just in the business too, to like control your emotions, like you're saying. And, you know, I call them speed bumps. You call them brake pads. You know, I think of it as like, you gotta have some speed bump type people that, you know, slow you down. The thing you have to avoid though is walls. You know, you don't want super pessimistic walls that just put themselves in front of everything and stop you from moving forward. But it's a healthy balance between, you know, that and speed bumps, I think.
Yeah.
Last few questions. How are you thinking, you know, what are the KPIs you're looking at? You talked about like ROIC, you know, even just if I look at like your revenue per employee, it's, you know, incredibly high, like 1.2 million per employee. You know, what are some of the things that you look at to know that the business is trending in the right direction and rally people around?
Yeah. I'm looking at competitive positioning and channels. I'm looking at how the investments that we have made over the course of the year, how those have panned out. I'm looking at profitability and making sure that from a kind of an EBITDA perspective and a cash flow perspective that the business is healthy. I'm looking at net.
Were you able to maintain profitability over the the margins that you've historically had over the last few years with all the inflationary pressures? Was it a matter of moving cost onto the customer? Was it a matter of just like being really good on the supply chain side?
We've had to raise prices some just because things cost more. For us, we get a pretty awesome amount of operating income leverage as we grow. And so we don't spend a lot of marketing, and I think SG&A might be less than 10% of revenue for us next year. And so that really, and it really helps us that just as we grow, it naturally pushes our margins towards increasing. Right now we're going to have the most profitable year by a really large margin next year that we've ever had. And it's probably a result of a lot of different things, but we've been profitable every year of the company. And, you know, again, this is the pro and the sometimes the drawback of being bootstrapped is like, we just haven't really had any other choice. With the rate that we're growing, we can't fund the inventory increases without running a profitable business. It's just the whole thing breaks. And there've been times where it's like, man, having an extra $5 or $10 million in this business would probably have helped me to, you know, have less gray hairs, but it has created this kind of discipline. And so we're finally getting to the scale where, like, between how bankable the business is and the cash flow, we can do a lot of things that other companies can't think about. Like one of the biggest ones for us is we're investing pretty significantly in domestic manufacturing. So we're going to open we've opened a facility. It'll start production in the next month. Next year, it probably will make about 3 million units. And we think we can create significant savings on units made domestically, multiple dollars a unit. So that's going to help tremendously. But it's another good example of you've just got to think long term, right? Like if you're fearful, you're just not going to be buying equipment and doing CapEx right now. But one of the things we've heard, ironically, is these retailers, they're like, our supply chain is a mess. Anything we can do to tighten up our supply chain and reduce our inventory risk, we're really excited about. And so, well, we're like, well, we can make things domestically. You know, we can shorten that supply chain up a lot. We can really reduce your risk of having excess inventory from us. And we can produce more kind of on demand in some areas. And they're really excited about that. So we have done some things that haven't really shown up on the income statement yet, but we'll start to next year when it comes to production. And then, like you said, you know, it's price increases. And I mean, really what it looks like is that we had a year where we kind of stayed flat on our profitability, even though we grew significantly because of investing in the future. And then,
which is relatively speaking, is probably pulling ahead of some other companies.
You know, one of the things I've come to appreciate is that when you look at your competitors, it's easy to look at what they're doing and to say, oh, they're doing that. That looks like that's working for them. We should do that. But you have to run your own race. And a lot of our competitors are just not running very profitable businesses, right? You know, like there's some that really are, you know, like Yeti and Hydro Flask, like they definitely are. And that's great. And then there's others where it's like, they're willing to take programs in mass retail where they're making 75 cents a unit or $1.50 a unit or something. And it's like, well, we could have that volume if we're willing to take that, but it just is not, those are just not opportunities that really make sense.
They're kind of hope strategies. You know, yeah. It's like, if we get our brand out there, hopefully one day it'll turn into a profitable business or something.
Right.
And there's not a lot of track record of that working, it seems.
No, I think that's where you really have to have the discipline to say no. I mean, this is one of the things about working with mass retailers, which we've had great buyers, great relationships, but there are power dynamics. And if you have to have them, right? Like if you're dependent upon them, then they are going to negotiate low prices from you and situations that are much more advantageous for them than for you. That's, you know, it's not them being bad people. It's like, that's the job. And you really have to be positioned as a brand where like you can walk away from deals because they're not the right fit for your company. And I think as we've developed the discipline around profitability and around how we invest our money, there've been times where we've walked away from multi-million-dollar deals because it just didn't make sense. And it really didn't fit with the type of company that we were trying to build. So the kind of combination of all those things, we've stayed very profitable. We think we'll be probably exceptionally profitable next year. But really to me, the thing that gets me excited about that is that we really see some ways that we can take that profitability and invest in things like production and new products. So I'm fired up about that.
At a high level, do you see a lot more brands going to U.S. manufacturing over the next, you know, 5-10 years? Do you think it's too hard?
I think probably not. I think that the ones that were going to probably would have done it over the last 2 years. I think the reason why I've spent a lot of time trying to understand, like, why is it that I haven't seen more of this? And in my industry, I kind of understood there's this kind of Venn diagram of three things. And you have to kind of hit that point where they all intersect for it to make sense. First is you have to be at pretty big volume. Like, you know, we're going to invest for like high level. We're probably going to invest about $20 million between 2021, 22, 23. And that $20 million probably gets us a facility that can make 10 million units a year. So what we're going to get for what we're going to spend is fantastic. But like being able to invest $20 million in anything requires you be at some pretty significant volume, probably knock some people out right off the bat. Then we have some competitors that are probably a big enough volume to do that, but their margin structure, like them saving an extra $1.50 on a unit, doesn't move their margins around a lot. And it makes more sense for them to invest that money into product dev or something else. And then the final piece is your ownership structure matters. If you're owned by a public company, if you're owned by PE, they're probably not super excited about sinking $20 million into investments in CapEx right now. And so you have to have kind of this combination of long-term oriented leadership and ownership, volume, and then a margin structure where this can really be, you know, can move your profitability significantly. For us, that's kind of where we're living. And as I kind of thought through our industry, I realized there's just not many people in our industry that actually all three of those things are simultaneously true. So there's definitely, I'm an advocate for it. And I think that it will be more accomplishable than ever before over the coming years. But I've been surprised by some of the statistics about how few people have actually done it. One more thing we're saying here. For a lot of companies, what makes it difficult is that you need all of these inputs, and those inputs are all coming from other places. And so you still have a ton of dependencies on the cost side and on the input side that make it less advantageous potentially to manufacture domestically. I mean, the biggest thing about China, most people don't understand this, but the biggest thing about China that makes them the destination for most people that are wanting to import is that they have this entire ecosystem, which is just amazing. So like they have, you know, with water bottles, there's like 10 different ways you can ornament these things. And there's a factory that does every single, there's probably five factories that does every single type within 100 miles of each other in one part of China. That's an ecosystem, right? Whereas if we're going to start making some of that stuff here, like we've got to individually develop 10 different ways, you know, because that just doesn't exist. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see. I would love to be a voice of, I'm going to really document what we're doing and how we're doing it. And hopefully I'm a voice that shows that it can be done and helps, you know, motivate and inform some other brand owners that they can do it. Because I do think it's better for, I think at a really high level, you win in business by creating value for other people. And domestic manufacturing will create more value in a lot of use cases because of tariffs and logistics costs and manufacturer margin. There's a lot of money that's getting eaten up, moving things around and making things other places.
Just the lack of flexibility absolutely. Makes it really tough to kind of be agile as a business. There's a lot of waste potentially.
There were orders we made from China where we would order it and we didn't get it until 180 days after we ordered it, or 100 and maybe even more, like 60 days of production, 120 days of like on the water. When you are trying to buy that far out, I mean, there's certain mass retail programs you kind of can, but when you're buying that far out, you're incredibly brittle, right? Like think about how much can happen in 6 months. Like if I could know what's going to go on 6 months from now, that would be really helpful in running my business. For me to be making bets for January or February of 2022 right now, it just makes me very susceptible to something significantly changing.
And you talk about a bunch of brands potentially being out of stock maybe next year if they swing too far. What's going to take them another 6 to 9 months to correct that?
That's right. Yeah. And you know what? In the land of Cyclops, in the land of blind men, the Cyclops is king. If you have the ability to make anything in a situation where other people don't have stuff, you're going to win. So we'll see. I'm really curious to see how we're able to leverage it and what it turns into.
I mean, this topic, you can go on for hours and hours. You can have an entire podcast dedicated to like onshoring US manufacturing. Yeah. I mean, one of the ways that you can kind of mitigate the risk for some of the brands that can't set this up themselves is to potentially turn this into like a co-manufacturing right. plant where people can use it as a contract manufacturer. Like, do you have any vision of kind of going that direction one day?
I have specific ideas on this. I think you can use contract manufacturing as a lever to grow your brand. So like for us, I think that what we will probably do is for some of our retail partners, we will say, hey, we're willing to save you money and make your life better by contract manufacturing for you in these areas in exchange for you really standing for the brand for us in these other areas. And that's a great deal for everybody, right? The customer wins, we win, the retailer wins. And so maybe at some point we'll talk more in depth about that, but definitely have some thoughts and plans around that.
Love it. All right. Last question. So for the founder that's listening to this right now, and maybe they're in a precarious spot given the economy and maybe some bad planning or whatever it might be in their business, what would be your advice to them for the next, 6 to 12 months to help them get through this kind of choppy period?
I think the first thing is avoid the sunk cost fallacy. Like, it doesn't matter what you thought 6 months ago. Like, all that matters is, like, where is the business today? And being able to look at it with a clear-eyed, accurate view of where it sits today. Is it viable? Because there's some businesses that just aren't viable that started over the last 2 years that it's just like, in the e-com space, there's some of this where it's like, well, in a world where Facebook's going to cost 50% more on customer acquisition, like, this is just not a viable business. And, sometimes if you find yourself in that situation, I've done it before. I've been running a business where I realized this is not viable. The quicker you quit, that's actually strength. And we don't talk about that enough, that quitting is actually sometimes the smartest move. I think that when it comes to making decisions about running your business, that this is going to be a time that's going to require persistence. When you're looking at the business, you say it's viable, it's just going to be tough. It's going to be a period that requires persistence and requires you to not get anchored onto anything you've done in the past. So, whether that's your team or your inventory decisions or your pricing, you have to say, what is the situation today? Where does the business need to be in order to be successful? And be willing to make the emotionally difficult decisions that that requires. And so one thing, though, that I think I struggled with this a lot. I'll make this the final point. I really care about my team members. And I view them as friends and as important relationships. And so I think team decisions are always the hardest. When you realize I just have too much overhead, or I can't justify, this person's salary or whatever. And here's the one thing I would say. I learned this too late in my career, but the number one thing that people need from me as a business owner is honesty and transparency. And, my goal with everybody that I employ is to help them to be successful. And the moment that I know that they don't have a good long-term future here, the absolute most caring thing I can do is to be honest and transparent with them about that and to help them find the right situation. For sure, there's some people that are like, hey, I've just got to get lighter on overhead, or I've just got to make cuts here or there. There is a way that we can do that where we treat people relationally instead of transactionally, where we help people to be successful and we help launch them out in being successful in the future. And then there's a way to do that that is probably all of the negative stereotypes that you sometimes hear about kind of corporate America. And so I think that was a helpful thing to realize, that the most caring thing I can do for somebody is look at them in their career and say, do I offer them the best opportunity right now? And if I don't, to either make the changes I need to be able to offer that to them or to help them to move towards that opportunity. So in addition to things I said today, I think that's probably the last thing I would I'd add. And also, like, it's hard. I'm empathetic. You can hit me up on Twitter and DMs or something if you have a specific question, because I do like to help whenever I can, just as a fellow operator.
Amazing. Yeah, I was just going to say, where's the best place for people to connect? I guess
probably Twitter and LinkedIn. Right? I'm there, more active on Twitter. Sharing. I try to be as responsive as I can be as kind of that's grown some. It's becoming more challenging, but for as long as I'm able to.
What's cool too is your team is on there.
Yeah, several of my team. I think I was kind of the first person to get really active on there, and then my team has gotten more active. And, like I said earlier to you, like, I view that as one of the opportunities is I can use that as a platform to help share things that have been helpful to us. And so I write quite a bit about, operating the business and things we're learning. And if people want to learn more about it, they can do that by following me.
Very cool. Well, this has been awesome. I mean, we could have talked again, like I said, for 2, 3, 4 hours. There's something about, you definitely have that kind of teacher mentality, ability to kind of break down complex topics in a way that's super helpful for people. So I think the more that you can share, the better. And I'm super excited to get this in the hands of people who are out there operating and executing on a daily basis. So we appreciate your time spending with us.
Well, thanks for having me on. I mean, I'm really admire what you've built and just how thoughtful you are at the point in your career that you are. Love talking with you, and I always love, like, you know, I just feel like it's kind of an iron sharpens iron thing, that when I get to spend time with people like you and other operators, I feel like it makes me better. So appreciate the time.
For sure. That's why I'm doing this as well, to help sharpen each other. So awesome, man. Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. More episodes are on the way. If you want to keep the conversation going, suggest questions, or nominate guests for future episodes, you can reach me on Twitter @MichaelMartocci. Good luck and see you next time.